Keep It is brought to you by Acorns. Lewis, what's one money lesson that you learned the hard way?
How about every time I get on Instagram, I am in serious danger of dropping $500 on whatever is thrown in front of me. It could be anything. It could be a shirt. It could be fuzzy dice. It's just, there's an endorphin boost I get from spending on things. I can't imagine. It has to be what steroids feel like. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, maybe you should be like a squirrel, because let me tell you, squirrels are nature's greatest investors. Why? Because squirrels spend a huge chunk of their lives stashing away their acorns. They save so many acorns, they have zero idea where most of them are, okay? But those acorns the squirrel totally forgot about, some of those grow into oak trees, and those oak trees grow into more acorns, and bam, that's why we love squirrels. They are living proof that anyone can be an investor. They just have to give their acorns a chance to grow.
Oh, who the fuck are you, Aesop?
I learned all of that from The Tree of Life.
Oh, really? Jessica Chastain. She had lessons for us. I had no idea. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that matches you and your money goals. You don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change.
So the reason I love Acorns is that I am always unsure about what to do with my spare change. If I'm getting, you know, change in my hand, I'm like, do I put it in my wallet? Do I stick it in my jeans? You know, I'm like, I'm confused. I'm frazzled. But when you tap and use Acorns, the app, it will save that spare change for you. And you won't even have to worry about investing.
I love thinking of you with harried character actress energy. I was like, you were played by Julie Bowen for a second.
I'm acting all over the city, Lewis.
Kathy Geiswhite, where are you? Sign up now and join the over 13 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $22 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/keepit or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/keepit.
And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I am Ira. If you do not buy my fucking book next week, I'm canceling the show and murdering all of you. Madison the Third.
As a nickname, I feel like that won't catch on, but okay. I'm Lewis Fertel, and it's Oscars nominations week. So as you know, I'm at my fullest form. I don't know. Is that the anime term? What is it? When you like become your... explain Pikachu when he becomes the other thing, Raichu? Anyway, I'm a
evolving
pop culture expert. Yes, evolving.
Lewis Chu.
Yeah, I fucking guess. And well, you know, painfully growing up, my family would be called Squirtle, because, you know, my last name is actually Vertel secretly. So it would be like Jim Vertel, Lewis, or Lewis Squirtle, Jim Squirtle, whatever. So it's actually a painful topic. Maybe I just needed therapy this entire time and I'm I'm bringing it up this way? I don't know.
You know, my grandmother recently sent me a text with a photo of a comic book, trading cards, and also Pokemon cards that I have still at the house. And I used to keep them all in one of those big-ass binders.
Oh, the way we would keep CDs in a binder. There's nothing I miss more than having my CDs in a binder. And I would bring them into school like a little librarian and then like comb through them to find whatever, Californication, and put it in the Discman. What a life I had.
Well, speaking of music, Lewis, I am currently in a state of eusexua,
I believe it's called. Me too. I have to say, I have to keep looking up the vowels in this word. It's a very kind of confusing word. We're talking about the new FKA Twigs album. And one of the few albums in recent memory that I would say defies genre. Like, it is poppy, but it is also not. And it's also reminds me of things. It had lots of 90s influences. It reminds me as much of kind of Madonna's moodier erotica bedtime stories music as it does things like Portishead, you know, and that kind of what we used to call trip hop. Remember those
yes.
words?
I was exactly going to bring up Trip Hop and Portishead, which I learned about, by the way, because Sarah Michelle Gellar in maybe like a Teen People interview or something said Portishead was her favorite band.
Well, also, let me tell you something. She hosted Saturday Night Live once, and I'm still, when I think of the band Portishead, I think of her introducing Portishead and being so psyched about it. So that was an unusually rad episode. Certain SNL episodes just like stand, do you have any SNL episodes that just stand out in your mind for whatever reason? I have two. One, when Helen Hunt hosted with musical guest Hanson, that was a hilarious Christmas episode, and also the most 1998 episode of all time, Scott Wolf with musical guest Natalie Imbruglia.
I think I always remember, I think, Britney Spears's episode, and the fact that you could never find online that sketch of the alleged dance battle she had with Justin Timberlake at a club after they broke up.
Right. Oh, yes, 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 yes. She was very funny in that morning latte, which remains my favorite recurring sketch in the history of SNL with Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry. Speaking of SNL, though, did you watch Madame Chalamet on the episode last week?
No, but I saw his fits, which is mostly what I meet Timothée Chalamet for.
No, he's always the hottest back-to-school sale look you can wear. You know, like the coat. The, you know, the way cool kids look in a Kohl's commercial, except he's 27 or whatever he is. The musical performance is very interesting. As you know, he's in this movie, A Complete Unknown. He is one of the Oscar nominees we'll be talking about today in this all Oscars episode, as I mandated when I took this job. But he performed songs of Bob Dylan's and not familiar ones. He actually began the episode by saying, you probably haven't heard of these. And so it was an interesting choice. I'm sure the way they were orchestrated on stage is not at all like the original versions, but I thought they were sort of the best parts of the episode. I enjoyed Weekend Update 2, which contained an awesome shout out to the WGA nominated game show Pop Culture Jeopardy. But the musical performance was great, and but a lot of the sketches he was in, and I assume Timothée Chalamet is just sort of game to be a bit immature on SNL and wants to let loose and not be self-serious or whatever. A lot of the sketches felt to me like they were written for all that.
Was he screaming a lot?
They were loud. There was a fitness thing where they were all on bungee cords and they were like throwing cake in each other's mouths. I was like, girl, where is Lori Beth Denberg to orchestrate this? My God.
That sounds like Randy and Mandy, the chocolate sketch. Oh,
you can't just take me to Randy and Mandy like that. Angelique Bates, come on, keep it.
Well, now I'm going to have to watch it because I feel like I have subterranean FOMO blues.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. You sound like a big Dylan fan. I can tell you go deep. Yeah.
Going back to this album, though, you know, I was also being reminded of Nine Inch Nails, who are going on tour this year. Thank God, because when I got the news that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross were not nominated for Challengers for Best Score, I was pissed. But then I saw Nine Inch Nails was going on tour, so I feel like that's a good trade-off. But a lot of Eusexual reminded me of that, and I want to ask you specifically, the song Girl Feels Good.
Yes.
Candy Perfume Girl, yes?
Quite, yes, which is a B-side on Ray of Light. As you know, that's Madonna's moodiest indigo-tinged albums. That's when the Kabbalah really came to the fore, and she was really speaking in mantras that somebody else taught her, and I don't know if she processed them, because there's a lot of lyrics on that album that don't make sense to me. But
the Kabbalah bracelet era was very big in celebrity at the time. It was just like this red string that people wore. You were either wearing a Kabbalah bracelet or you were wearing a Livestrong bracelet.
Livestrong, I would say, followed shortly thereafter. But yes, if you were Gwyneth or Stella McCartney or Madonna, yes, you wore these red strings and it was, you know, a little creepy. But it was you knew something about yoga and mysticism that was kept from the rest of us and will forever not really understand what that is. Yes.
Interesting, because I feel like when Madonna always has eras that resurface, right? You know, we had our 80s moment. We had our, like, 90s moment, I guess, in pop culture of those resurgences. And I feel like those were the songs that she played on the tour recently. And, you know, we're gay, so we're always listening to the Confessions on a Dance Floor era, and Hard Candy is what you'll hear sometimes when you go out, right? But I think we've really not had a resurgence of her Ray of Light era yet.
Yeah.
Musically.
There was a moment when I was thinking about this era recently, because that song Aquamarine by by Edison yes. Ray sort of harkens back to that. Also, she literally says the words ray of light in the lyrics, which is cheating. Either evoke the era, you either evoke the era or literally just talk about the era. It can't be both. But yeah, I think people would be pleased to listen to that entire album back. Like Confessions, it feels like it flows from one song to another, not quite as literally as Confessions, but it's just really pleasing music that sort of doesn't feel just 90s, or it feels 90s in a good way, like Clueless.
It's the music that I feel like I was really introduced to Madonna on, because, you know, kids don't remember this, but when you wanted to watch a music video that you loved on VH1 or MTV, you had to sit through many videos to get to the one that you actually wanted to watch. You couldn't just pull it up on YouTube. And so I was constantly seeing Madonna Ray of Light era music videos when I turned on VH1 because I wanted to see The Boy Is Mine or something.
Right. Oh, I see. Oh, you didn't want to watch Madonna videos. You were trying to get to
Brandy. Well, because I didn't really know her yet. Yes. You know, I feel like I didn't hear that much Madonna 80s stuff. It was before the 80s sort of really roared back in the 2000s, and you would hear 80s music everywhere. But I feel like that was my first real introduction to Madonna. And then when music came out in 2000, I remember kids at school loved this song. And it was like they were discovering Madonna for the first time, too.
You also just put your finger on something I totally forgot about, which is once upon a time, you made music videos competitively. Like, you needed to get on the air. So you had to have, like, a kind of hook that really brought people in. And that I think, is the difference between, you know, music videos are still really popular now, but you can kind of do whatever you want. And, you know, because it's going to live online forever. But once upon a time, you know, Madonna's like, I'm going to be in a desert. It's going to be tinged blue and I'm going to turn into a dog. And we're going to sing the words Frozen again and again. Okay. Anyway, wow, you detoured me into Madonna. I blame you. This FKA Twigs album, it's a strange beast. I don't have quite my arms around what this thing is, but it even kind of intersects with Brat Summer type music a couple of times.
Is it affecting Los Angeles? Because I feel like you bring up Brat Summer, and there was constantly a Brat this, Brat going on in New York. And I feel like, first of all, this bitch has had a eusexual rave every other week.
Oh, she
has. All across the globe. But also there have been several eusexual parties or pop-ups or listening things in New York. And I'm just wondering if it's just because New York is ripe for that, because there are more clubs, there are more people who are into this sort of music, which she described as inspired by the techno clubs of Prague, because I feel like she just didn't want to say Berlin.
Right. Yeah.
Like, what's going on in Prague? I went to Prague, but there wasn't much going on. There was beer. There was some good food.
They got the Danube.
But yeah. But Prague was not Prague-ing.
Okay.
For
it.
Me.
I'm going to Berlin for the first time in March, so we can come back to this conversation. But I would say people are aware of FKA Twigs. And again, we are obviously in YouTube afters culture. And she is, if one thing is consistent about FKA Twigs, it's the wild ass videos where you're sitting
Drums
there.
Drums of Death is a beautiful video. I think that just like the HR Britney womanizer of it all, with the dancing in the chairs, I fucking love that video.
She's also a really awesome vocalist, though I will say this. I love the experimental nature of her music, which is always experimental. I don't know that I'm always loving what she's doing with her voice. Like, there's a kind of high-pitched thing going through this music here that I don't want to call it. It just feels a little bit cloying to me. I don't know.
I feel like my favorite era of hers was when she made Holy Terrain. I love that song with Future. And I liked sort of like her hip-hoppy, trip-hop vibes. And so I'm happy that it's back on this album. I will say, Miss Twigs, you owe us a fucking song. Because I know you remember Dua Lipa's Future Nostalgia Live that happened during COVID.
Yes.
And you remember when she was dancing on the stripper pole at one point. It's an unreleased song of Dua's and FKA Twigs.
Okay, well, that is unacceptable because Dua released everything from that era seemingly, and yet not that.
It has never come out, and it's called Why Don't You Love Me, and it's people have put it onto SoundCloud, so you can go and listen to it if you want. But come on, girl. It could have been a Radical Optimism B-side.
I mean, because Radical Optimism, as you know, I believe was B-sides. I wasn't getting a content from that.
It's so weird that that tour is happening later this year.
I know. I mean, it's not a terrible album. It's just not, like, momentous, really. I'm still obsessed mm-hmm. with the Dua Lipa song, That Kind of Woman, which was released on the Midnight Edition or whatever of Future Nostalgia. Love that song.
And If It Ain't Me, which was originally supposed to include Normani, there was a leak of that, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
then Normani was snatched off the song, probably because she just didn't come to the studio.
Right. That does sound like her, doesn't it? Anyway, yeah. What's going on this episode? What are we doing?
This episode, we are, first of all, to go back to the era of music that we were talking about before, we have the Christina Milian joining us this week.
Who I routinely call Christina Brilliant. If longtime fans of the Keep It podcast know, I innovated that.
We, in the early days of Keep It, were obsessed with the fact that she was the social media correspondent for The Voice.
Right, because it was a show that was figuring out what it was doing, really. Like, did that show really need a social media correspondent? And so, yeah, anyway, Christina Milian of the Dipping It Low and Picking It Up Slow. She's here.
Yeah, when I am thinking of anything, what time it is, when it goes from a.m. to p.m., it's always her.
Miss Milian's here. She's like, yeah, she's like Greenwich Standard Milian. Yeah.
And of course, as we said before, this is all about the Oscar nomination. So when we're back, we'll get into those. Look, we know political news feels bad right now. We're down. We're very, very down. But we're definitely not out. Our friends at Vote Save America are creating space for you to recharge, find solace in community, have a little fun, and figure out what you can do to protect communities at risk under Trump and build progressive power in 2025 and beyond.
Go to votesaveamerica.com and sign up for their email list to get the next steps. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Last week, the Oscars finally dropped this year's nominations. There weren't many surprises on who made the cut and who got snubbed. But I'll tell you what. Nobody's happier than that puta, Emilia Perez.
Also, I mean, we're pretending that that's like harsh language. I was saying to you before we got on, people are angrier than ever about Emilia Perez. I have not seen backlash like this to a movie in the Oscars conversation in 100 years. And by the way, I want to say, people, I've heard a couple of statistics like, there's no lower, if it wins Best Picture, it'll be the lowest Best Picture, rated Best Picture since like Crash. Guys, there have been plenty of worse Metacritic rated movies that were nominated for Best Picture. I mean, like, if you look at Joker alone or The Blind Side, like, there are things that like barely pass like 50 on Metacritic. Emilia Perez is firmly like 71, like in the green scale. But that said,
John Waters likes it.
Oh, does he? As far as I know, that's the right side of history. So, you know, I'm living in an uncomfortable space where I, generally speaking, like Emilia Perez.
You two pink flamingos hanging out.
We're about to have female trouble because we're about to get the shit kicked out of us. I will say another thing about Emilia Perez that's interesting this year is that it got 13 nominations, which is almost ties it for all time. I think people are making a little bit too much hay out of this. The fact of the matter is a musical is just going to be more eligible for certain categories than a regular movie. Like the fact that it has two original song nominations alone is going to set it apart from the pack. La La Land got the same amount of nominations. And I don't think anybody's sitting here thinking, oh, that's a top six or seven movie of all time.
Well, I mean, La La Land compared to Emilia Perez, I mean, La La Land's going to devour Perez.
You know what's interesting, though? People keep, like, pulling out, we talked about this before, like, pulling out scenes from Emilia Perez, putting them online and saying, look at this piece of shit. Okay. Mm-hmm. I will say, when you watch Emilia Perez, though, to me, it is a movie that to me is saying, take it or leave it at any given time. Like, it's knowingly kooky, knowingly ridiculous. And it's completely
fair. Guess I'm leaving. Okay. I'm gone.
I was about to say, it's completely fair to not like it and to think like the kookiness is more stupid than good or adventurous, I guess. But I feel like it's pretty aware of that. It sort of reminds me of when people criticize Tar for being pretentious. It's like, guys, that's the whole point of the movie. You haven't engaged with the content at all.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know that I'm a Tar baby, okay? I love.
Please don't. And then her name is Blanchett, which means white. Anyway, there's an essay here. Yeah.
But I will say that I have softened in my old age. You know, I'm not as, I don't have as much vitriol to give towards Oscar nominations anymore.
Okay.
You know, I've passed.
You're saving it for the fight. Yeah.
I've passed the high school era of Crash with everyone hating it. And even La La Land, when I was upset about it, it was only in contrast to wanting Moonlight to win.
Right.
And it was also really just the dumb jazz storyline in it. I mostly enjoyed La La Land, and I rewatched it since. I enjoy the movie for the most part. And I feel like Emilia Perez, I don't like it. But I will say that when I watched it at IFC, I was cackling.
Yes.
And I was one of the first people to start cackling. And then the audience was, when people are realizing a movie is not great and they're doing the soft cackles and then all of a sudden like everyone gets into it, it's infectious. I was carrying during that movie. At a certain point you're just like, okay, here's what's happening.
Yeah. I will say, does it, I like the movie, was amused by the movie, thought it was, you know, mostly on the rails, even though it's a crazy movie. I don't know that I needed to be a front runner in the Oscars conversation. That said, I would not call myself really bowled over by this year's Oscar movies. So it's sort of difficult for me to say where it really belongs. Like, I'm looking at these other Best Picture nominations and it's like, I really liked Anora. I'm sort of surprised to look at these and think, I guess Anora's my favorite. Like, it doesn't feel like a favorite to me. It feels like something that would be fourth or fifth ranked otherwise. I also, of course, really enjoy The Brutalist outside of two plot points that make me scream when I think of them. Mm. And I don't want to spoil that for you or anybody here, but woof. Guy Pearce, when you read that script, tell me, girl, what you went through and who you spoke to, because it had to have been a deep conversation.
I think of the films nominated for Best Picture, which are Anora, The Brutalist, A Complete Unknown, Conclave, Dune Part 2, Emilia Perez, I'm Still Here, Nickel Boys, The Substance, and Wicked. My favorite is Wicked. I think that
I'm going to go ahead and leave, so you can just talk to your fucking self. Okay.
Well, I meant to say Anora. I'm sorry. My favorite is Anora with Wicked and Nickel Boys probably in second.
Yeah. Nickel Boys is a very interesting movie. I don't know if we've talked about it much, but it's from the perspective of these two boys and literally, as in you're watching the movie out of their eyes, which I don't remember the last time I saw a movie like that. And it ends up, I mean, it's an incredibly harrowing movie. And Anjanou Ellis Taylor gives a performance as one of the boys' mothers that really anchors it in this emotion we can latch on to also. It's a really impressive movie. It's also a bit frustrating and there's a lot of sort of filmic things that occur. Like there's like montage-y things that I found a bit disorienting and I don't know if the movie needed it. But I'm really glad that snuck into Best Picture. And also, have we talked about I'm Still Here yet? Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet, but it is still in theaters, so.
Yes. Let me say this about this movie. Fernanda Torres, who was nominated, we talked about how she's the first Brazilian actress to be nominated for Best Actress since her own mother, Fernanda Montenegro, who appears at the end of this movie, too.
Wepa.
Okay, thank you for that. Capoeira. I don't know anything about Brazil. Okay. I think there's a lot of heat behind this performance. I feel like she is now the front runner to win Best Actress. And this is an interesting year because all five nominees are from movies that are nominated for Best Picture. It's Cynthia Erivo in Wicked, Carla Sofia Gascon and Emilia Perez, Mikey Madison and Anora, Demi Moore in The Substance, and Fernanda Torres in I'm Still Here. She, of course, won the dramatic Golden Globe category for Best Actress. And weirdly, it's even though it's about a real time of a political upheaval in Brazil in 1971, they were under a military dictatorship and this woman's husband is taken away from her. She's thrown in prison for a second. It weirdly to me feels like a Oscar nomination from the 40s. And by that, I mean, Greer Garson would be in movies where something terrible would happen to her and then she would do seven dignified things. And then that was the movie. So, meanwhile, Fernanda Torres is brilliant. Her choices make scenes that would otherwise be kind of obvious, like her looking around at seeing families with a father figure still present and having an emotional reaction. That seems pretty obvious. And then you watch her do it, and it's like, nope, I'm right there in it with you. This is extremely emotional. I think based on quality of what she does alone, she's my favorite of these. But at the same time, the character kind of has no flaws. Like, she's a real-life activist, and we don't get to see her play any internal struggle about what to do that isn't her just making the right call.
Mm-hmm. I hate to say this, but, you know, I'm a bit of an America First person when it comes to the Oscars. I just think that, you know, our actors aren't being nominated in Brazil. We're not being nominated that much for BAFTAs and shit, you know? But it's always a British actor. It's always a foreign actor. The movies are always getting into Best Picture when we have Best International Feature.
we have this ghettoized category for you, and you won't even use it.
I'm just like, not to be xenophobic, you know? But I feel like we have non-white actors in America, right? Who are constantly wanting them to be nominated for things. We're constantly wanting opportunities for them, you know? And I feel like now you have people who are up against not just like the white people who are always getting nominated, but also now international people. And it's like, well, goddamn, you could watch Emilia Perez, but you couldn't watch a film with Daniel Deadweiler in it.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Like,
trust
you couldn't, you know?
Don't set me off on the Danielle Deadweiler thing. First of all, no, I don't, I believe it. Is it like illegal to talk about Piano Lesson? I've not heard one goddamn person bring up this movie where she, again, like, is saddled with so much. She has to make this weird story about literally just a piano and what she's going to do with it and the fight she has with her brother about it. Fascinating. And beyond just a play we're seeing filmed for Netflix. And it's a transcendent performance.
I blame R.L. Stein, you know, because people still think piano lessons
can be
murder.
Right. Yes. That is a shame. Jane Campion, too. She got us all stigmatized against pianos. I don't want Harvey Keitel lingering by the keys.
Yeah. But, you know, I just feel like Davine Joy Randolph, you know, if she had been nominated in this year, and obviously Oscars are all about luck, too. You know, it depends when you're nominated because you could have an amazing killer performance that would win any other year. But if you're up against something else that has the momentum, et cetera. But, you know, would she win in this year?
Well, that's a good question. Because Zoe Saldana is, of course, dominating every frame of Emilia Perez. Almost
with her category fraud.
Yes, almost certainly belongs in the lead actress category. But I always think, like, routinely in my head, I'm, like, pairing old nominations against new ones. Like, for instance, I don't think anyone ever could have beaten Jennifer Hudson in Dreamgirls. Like, everything was stacked in her favor. You know what I mean? Like, truly, she could have, like, what's my best? Like, if Sandy Dennison, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, my favorite winner in that category, were up against Jennifer Hudson, she would lose. There's just no question. And Monique is a similar situation, too. That kind, because it's not just performance. It is literally a booming performance. Like, and I think there are certain qualities about certain performances that make them undeniable, and that's
and
one
no
of them.
Promo. Okay,
yes,
she got it with no promo.
No, she said, "I did Sundance and I'm done." Yeah,
that is interesting, you know. And I'm sure you have a trophy strife coming out soon where you'll talk about like the nominations, etc. But when I'm thinking about people who were nominated and historically in this category, you know, you're looking at Best Actress. For me, I'm still rooting for Mikey Madison. I know she's not going to win. I think that she is just happy to be nominated at this point, and it's such a boon for her as a young ingenue, as they say. You know, it feels sort of like a Jennifer Lawrence moment for her.
I was going to say the same thing. Like Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone is what this performance reminds me of, where it's like the whole movie is her. Like if you're absorbed in the movie, that means she's doing a good job. But she's so new on the scene. It's sort of like a, not a crowning moment, sort of, it's like a debutante ball introduction. Yes, right.
Yes, introducing Mikey Dandridge.
Yes.
As it were. But I think it these nominations stack up to, I think, Demi Moore winning or Fernanda Torres winning. I think those are people who could definitely beat some other front runners in another year. I think that Jessica Chastain winning in 2022 was plenty of these nominations could have knocked that out of the water.
Right. That was a case of, oh, we all know what Tammy Faye looks like. And did she do a good job as her? Yes. Like, you know, sometimes it's just that math of, did she play this person we're familiar with successfully? You know, lots of biopic people end up taking the crown ultimately. Yeah, I mean.
Here's a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Amy Adams, who we love, and yes. We were hoping would maybe have something going on this season until we saw Night Bitch.
Right.
Do you
and then
think
we said
that...
Night Bitch. Yes, right.
You know, that's the sequel to Night Mother.
I've been waiting for it for years. I was like, that girl's dead in that bedroom, but I want more. Yeah.
Well, you find out the bullet missed.
Oh.
That's how Night Bitch opens up. And the mother's like, God damn it, I'll do it myself.
Oh, instead of convincing her not to kill herself, she's like, I'm after you now that you wasted my time. Yeah.
Here's just a fun hypothetical question. For imagine any of the other movies Amy Adams was in that we've wanted her to win for.
Sure.
If she's nominated for Best Actress in this year, do you think she would have a chance of winning or being a front runner?
Well, it's something that is very telling to me is that Nicole Kidman, for some reason, didn't get in. And I feel like what she does in that movie is kind of an Amy Adams performance. You know, it's like a very insular... we're locked into her line of thinking and seeing her navigate a difficult situation and watching her almost have a panic attack at some point. That feels like a very Amy Adams sharp objects-y role.
You know what I'll say though? That movie, and I don't know what your experience has been hearing people talk about it in LA, but Baby Girl, more often than not, is a movie that people are asking me if I've seen it and then telling me how much they hated it.
Interesting. What's weird is, like, I thought the eroticism of the movie worked, like, is the calling card of the film, the reason you would go and see it. I do think, ultimately, it didn't do much with the power dynamics at play, other than saying, like, oh, she's a powerful woman and she has to manage it. Also, I do feel like there is something a bit tropey about a woman, like, a 50-something woman who can't have an orgasm. Like, that, to me, feels a little first thought. I don't know.
And this isn't just, you know, gays with opinions, okay? I'm hearing this from, you know, friends who are like actual sex workers, you know, in New York, who are just sort of like, this isn't the vibe, you know? They've been that client, you know? So they've been in the room where it happened, and they're like, they're not buying it. And everyone also, maybe we're going to have a resurgence of this movie, but everyone keeps comparing it to Unfaithful, too, saying, bring back real erotic thrillers. I think really the third act and the denouement of this film does not live up to the erotic thrillers of yesteryear. And I think that's what people are really sort of missing. Baby Girl sort of falls flat for me.
No, this is a spoiler, so if you haven't seen it yet, but like once Antonio Banderas gets into a fight with Harris Dickinson, I said, I do not believe that scene for a second. My favorite erotic thriller is Damage with Julia Binoche and Jeremy Irons. I'm always bringing it up. The final act of that, where his... wife who finds out about it, the moment she gets, it's like, I did not see that coming, wasn't anticipating it because I was too busy watching the hot sex between Jeremy Irons and Julia Binoche. Those kinds of surprises are what Baby Girl needed. Now, speaking of other snubs, let me get through this quickly. Marion John Baptiste and Hard Truths. Okay, it felt like people didn't really see that movie or like dial into it. The movie itself is sort of unassuming in a way, like in a way where it's like maybe not even clamoring for Oscar attention, even though she gives such a brilliant performance in it. This wouldn't piss me off so much that her not getting into this, and she is nominated for the BAFTA, and I'm kind of hopeful for her there. But anyway, it wouldn't bother me so much if Kieran Culkin and A Real Pain weren't giving an extremely similar performance and the utter front runner in the category. Where it's about a prickly person where we're like, why can't they just fit in with everybody? What's with their vibe? Why are they such What is lurking in their brain that's making them act this way?
It's Succession. It's people's familiarity with Kieran Culkin and sort of love of him within the industry that has gotten him this nomination. And that's not to say I didn't love that performance. Mm-hmm. I really do enjoy that movie.
It was a good performance,
but,
yeah.
But I think it's definitely coming off the heels of Succession, him and Jeremy Strong being nominated in the same category, Jeremy for The Apprentice. I think that's what it is.
And of course, we've now, there are a number of famous Roy Cohn performances now. Jeremy Strong's own idol, Al Pacino in Angels in America is a very famous example of it. There was that guy in Fellow Travelers who played Roy Cohn. And it almost feels like you just dial into this one mode of talking when you're being Roy Cohn. You know, there's like footage of him. We know that he's this blowhard. So in a way, it feels to me like the level of difficulty is low. That said, the movie The Apprentice, I'm not mad at it. I thought it was like kind of well done. I don't know about tasteful, but I got a surprising Trump performance out of it. And we have Sebastian Stan as a first time nominee here. Viva Romania. Okay. I don't know that I'm... I thought initially that I was sort of over Jeremy Strong's performance, and now I'm sort of happy it's there.
You know, I just wish that anything about Roy Cohn would give us something new and different, you know? Yeah. Like, he died in 86. I want someone to get into, you know, this closeted gay man who went to the Celine Dion en concert tour in 1985 secretly, you know? I'm assuming he did.
Oh, okay. You know? I was like, did you do that investigation yourself? Yeah.
Or maybe he went to the Private Dancer tour, you know? I would love to see Roy Cohn going to see Private Dancer.
The last thing he did was, yeah, perform Typical Male lip syncing for his friends in Palm Springs. Right.
And also, speak of Tina Turner, did you know that we got a lost song this weekend?
Okay, my friend Dan Zach posted it, and I still haven't listened to it yet. Is it good?
It's good. It's called Hot For You, Baby. You can see why it was left off the Private Dancer album. You know, it's not as maybe nuanced as some of those other songs. It sort of feels a bit one note. And towards the end, you sort of say, okay, this song has maybe gone on too long. But it feels like a fun song that you could throw on at a party or remix. And it's just nice to hear Tina in that era again.
Oh, that is particularly nice. I was just thinking of her this week because, as you know, in LA, we got rain. And Tina's version of I Can't Stand the Rain on the Private Dancer album is banger-rific. I mean, no offense to Missy Elliott, who I believe, you know, should be on like Mount Rushmore. But I think this is the definitive version of that number.
Yeah. All right. When we are back, we have a lot more Oscar nominations to talk about.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, I've done therapy for a while, and I find that the most helpful thing about it is identifying the parts of my life where there is dread, where I am thinking to myself, oh, I'm sitting around wishing this thing that's going to happen isn't going to happen, even though just confronting it and thinking about it and identifying it would make me realize, whatever, my day will move on. We'll all live. And BetterHelp is an amazing way to help identify these things. BetterHelp is fully online, making therapy affordable and convenient, serving over 5 million people worldwide. Access a diverse network of more than 30,000 credentialed therapists with a wide range of specialties. Easily switch therapists anytime and at no extra cost.
Around these parts, we used to call Lewis Judge Dredd.
Oh.
But now he can write his own story with BetterHelp. And so can you. Visit BetterHelp.com/keepit. to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/keepit. And we are back with more Oscar nominations chat on Keep It. Lewis, Isabella Rossellini, she got it.
I know. And also, not only did she get it, she was not lingering in fifth or sixth place. Like, she was probably in the three zone in terms of likeliness on these nominations, so I can't even say I'm surprised. As you know, we have had that woman on the show. She is, of course, a genius. Her interest in animal sexuality is second to none. She is a truly strange bird, and she will tell you how strange birds fuck. she will tell you.
She is so sweet. I have at least three friends who saw Death Becomes Her, the musical, the night that she attended it, and they all have photos with her. They said she was so nice to everyone in the audience.
Okay, I'm sure. And of course, like, she's the daughter of Ingrid Bergman and seems every inch of that. Like, we love the family, love Roberta Rossellini. I will say about this performance, people keep claiming she has a big moment. Like, she delivers this monologue and it's Slay or whatever. I would call it half of a monologue. And also, is that really what you remember? Or is it just that she is the only woman in the movie? That is what is memorable about the performance. That, I think, also makes me mad at the nomination, because it's just that Kim Basinger in LA Confidential thing. It's like, no, there was one pretty woman and 90 guys. Like, that's the novelty of the performance. So she is memorable, but I think it is like a ratios thing.
I think you sort of need a moment from her toward the end of the movie, especially considering the twist.
Correct.
Also, but she drops out right after that scene.
No, correct. I would actually, this isn't quite the same thing, but Monica Barbaro up for A Complete Unknown, where she plays Joan Baez. For Oscar-nominated performances, I liked everything I saw on screen from both of these people. It did feel like they were a scene and a half short. You know, just like where's the other moment where they have a turn or something? Because Monica Barbaro has a very winning presence, and she also has that strange calm that Joan Baez had, which, if you've seen the documentary on Joan Baez, you know that her life is riddled with anxiety, as in I still have anxiety thinking about that documentary. But she conjured something very real and palpable about Joan Baez in that movie. But I just, it's almost like the Elle Fanning character should have had one less scene and she should have had one more.
I mean, a movie about a male musician gives a short shrift to the women involved.
I know. It seems crazy. Right. Not a complete unknown to me. I've seen it before.
Ariana Grande, I'm happy for the nomination.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll say this about, I can't deny that almost every time she had a comedic line, I'm laughing at the line. Like, she was dialed into the comedy of the role. And also, Wicked is a phenomenon. It belongs in this conversation. And also, I think at this point, it's fair to say she is like the runner-up to win, because Zoe Saldana, I don't know that Ariana has won much of anything in the run-up to this, but because Zoe Saldana is almost certainly going to take it. But I think she's in second place here. Felicity Jones is really good in The Brutalist. It's nice to see her again. She was nominated once for The Theory of Everything, a movie that I have to say, an amazing score. That's the thing I remember most about that movie, other than, you know, Eddie Redmayne doing one of his famous Guess Who impressions, which is what he does on the silver screen.
And the stage.
Yes, quite.
If you saw Cabaret.
Apparently that Day of the Jackal show is good. I haven't seen it yet. But Felicity Jones in this movie has, first of all, one of the definitive hand job scenes of the 2020s. Hand jobs, underrepresented in cinema. Do you know what I think is the one that sticks out of my mind most? Nicole Kidman, you are correct.
Killing of a Sacred Deer.
That, first of all, there's like five scenes in that movie where it's just like, what? Like the introduction of Barry, that was how Barry Keoghan was introduced to us. And we're like, oh, he's like a crazy person. Okay. But that hand job that Nicole Kidman gives in that movie, I'm still being jerked around by that scene. I'm still being jerked around.
She was gooning for her life, okay? She was up for elimination.
The gooning of a sacred deer. Oh, my God.
Okay, best supporting actor. I was shocked, actually, at Yura Borisov getting a nomination for Anora, which is, I don't know why I'm shocked, because he was maybe one of my favorite parts of the film outside of Mikey, but wow, I think that was a shock for me, his nomination. I thought that the Russian Timothée Chalamet was going to get in.
I fucking loved that performance. I loved Russian Timothée Chalamet. I love actors who are just all clavicle. You know, you just see everything jutting out of the skin. But also, people are not only into this performance and into him. Obviously, he's like, looks like a model. But they are defensive about this performance. They're like, if you're not locked into this performance, you're not getting Anora. Like, this movie needs this performance. And by the end, I guess you do get a arc from him. And I like where their relationship goes. And he obviously holds her during the crucial emotional moment of the film. I do think he is a bit of a white knight as a character, though, for me. Like, he appears in the movie. he's on the bad guy's side, and then he has this conscience that sort of grows and grows, and he builds this rapport with Honora that turns emotional. He does that well. I just think that character, it never felt real to me. I don't think anybody, I mean, that would, you know.
No shade. He is giving Lenny from Of Mice and Men for about half the movie.
One of your favorite literary references.
Yeah. And
No shade.
I also think it's, I don't know, that scene at the end, I was rooting for their sort of relationship. I was locked in from the beginning.
Yeah, maybe you were shipping them, as we used to say. Yes.
I was. I was on the message boards, okay? Mm-hmm. I said, move over, Mulder and Scully. Yeah. Honora and the Russian. But I will say, as much as I love the film, and like I said, it's my favorite in the Best Picture race, the one rough scene for me is that, like, not their final moment, the moment before their final moment where we're just throwing, like, around fag and rape every 2 seconds. I was sort of like, this felt like a acting exercise that someone filmed.
Oh, right. This is when they're, like, randomly watching the news for a whole scene?
Yes.
Who picked this? It's like, it's such a weird way to end the movie. Like, it's like, mm-hmm. I think it's supposed to build a certain chemistry between them, but it's filmed jarringly. It's like from this downward angle and they're on the couch. It almost looks like you're watching like Paranormal Activity or something. Yeah, that is a really strange part of the movie.
It was a Cassavetes rough cut. And yeah. I love Sean Baker, but could have done a little less with that. I think that, obviously, we talked about Kieran Culkin already. I love Edward Norton in anything, even The Incredible Hulk, you know? So,
and, I think we talked about Primal Fear before. What a fun, yes. very like a kind of Agatha Christie-like performance. If you've ever seen like Witness for the Prosecution or something, you know, what's up with mm-hmm. this witness? And then are we getting the real story? It's a fun performance to dig into.
One of the few white actors who Spike Lee has sort of like been able to work with and like turn it out with in the 25th hour.
He has a big speech about actors in Birdman that I love, where he name drops people like Geraldine Page. And once you do that, it's forever with me, babe. We're going the long haul.
He's a page boy.
Yes. Page boy. I pretend like he wrote it. Anyway, he didn't, but we should talk about Best Original Song, because what the fuck is going on here, babes? We've got...
Do we have to?
Two from Amelia Perez. The Journey from 6888, which is written by Diane Warren, who has now been nominated, I believe, 8 years in a row. I think she has 16 nominations altogether, and none are for Guantanamo, where she should be sent.
Speaking of I'm Still Here...
She's the I'm Still Here-est who ever lived.
I believe that the Oscars, I believe the official ballot at this point just has Diane Warren's name on it and a blank space where you write in the song each year.
No, it's like Putin. Yeah, right. Like, did you check the Putin box? Because it's not fitting into the, it's not fitting in unless you do. Also, I mean to say, she has terrific songs, some of like the best ballads ever. I love How Do I Live. I love There You'll Be from Pearl Harbor and stuff. But the past decade of nominations, I mean, I would be hard pressed to remember any one of those songs. I'm like the lyrics to Applause from a couple of years ago or a year ago. Absolutely not. But it's weird. Like, she doesn't have a ton of competition here. I guess a song from Amelia Perez will take it, right? It's like the musical that's eligible in this category. So it makes sense that that would win. But
unless, you know, and this comes sometimes happen when two songs are nominated. Maybe they, you know, cancel each other out.
I mean, she has an honorary Oscar already. So now we're just like gooning again until she fucking clinches this damn thing.
And then Best Original Score, as I said at the top of the episode, what the fuck? With challengers not getting in. And I don't know how much I believe this, but I've heard that, you know, Luca was really sort of pushing for Trent's score for Queer instead of Challengers. And did he see that movie?
That is a tough movie that got totally shut out here. One snub, you could say, is in the best actor category. Daniel Craig didn't get in for Queer. Though I would say this, and I get into this in my Trophy Strife episode about the Oscar nominations coming up. Queer is not a movie that is really best defined by any one of its elements. You know, like, it's just a big directorial experience. I don't think, I didn't come away from that movie thinking, like, Drew Starkey or Daniel Craig gave anything in particular that was needing to be awarded. Like, they fit into the tableau of what we're seeing perfectly, but it's just not like a, no one element was breakout. I did love the score during the scene where there's a snake attack. That turned into some Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross, gay Molly hits kind of vibe, which, as you know, they specialize in.
You know, Queer is sort of a stone soup of movies, if you will. You know, everyone tossed something in, and I guess it tasted great at the end if you like the taste of shoes.
It was a very muddy, murky movie. And afterwards, there's no version of watching that movie where you don't take a moment afterwards to be like, okay, what did I get out of that?
Yeah, it's so weird to have a movie where I love so many elements of it, but at the end, I'm just sort of like, I'm sending it back to the chef.
Yes, sure. And I hate to say this, I think the male, I think the actor nominations outclass the actress ones this year, because I'm looking at Best Actor, and this to me is the most interesting race. Adrian Brody is probably still ahead, even in the midst of this conversation about how they used AI to tweak his Hungarian accent or make it more authentic. I don't think anybody's watching this movie and thinking, well, he's a bad actor and AI made it possible. Like, Adrian Brody's a good actor. I'm so sorry.
I'm just saying Nicki Minaj was able to deliver Hungarian when she was on the Flawless remix, and he should have been able to do it too.
Okay. I do not need to hear him on the Flawless remix. But we also had Timothy Chalamet in A Complete Unknown. Coleman Domingo and Sing Sing. By the way, that'd be a good win. Wouldn't hate that. Ralph Fiennes and Conclave. It's so weird that Ralph Fiennes is not nominated for Best Actor, and I think he's definitely in fifth place. Like, there's just nothing about that performance that's clamoring for a win here. It's not like an emotionally demanding performance, even though he's perfectly lovely in it. In a way, it feels sort of like Conclave could have been a TV show, and he would be like the Emmy nominee lead for that show. And then, of course, Sebastian Stan in The Apprentice is Donald Trump. And I've got to tell you, it's pretty rare for someone to be nominated for a movie where they play the sitting president who rapes his wife. That is a major scene in the film.
Yeah. I love Sebastian Stan. You know that A Different Man was maybe my favorite film of the year. And it didn't get a Best Picture nomination or really any nominations. It sort of got shut out. But I love Sebastian Stan. Would love a win, if only because it would piss off Donald Trump so much.
But and he will definitely be watching the Oscars. So,
Of course. She's a fan. She double taps. Okay. But I am pretty sure that Adrian Brody is going to win. And my question is, and Emma Stone is so funny and so game for doing shit like this. And usually the Best Actress winner presents to Best Actor, yes.
Yes. Oh, you want her Halle Berry?
And kiss Adrian Brody like he did to Halle Berry. Come on. Wow. Come on. That would be beautiful.
And she's so short, too. So that would be like doubly hilarious. I like the instinct. I like the instinct. I also really enjoyed, by the way, Nikki Glaser's joke about Adrian Brody at the Golden Globes, two-time Holocaust survivor. That was very funny. Very funny. And now to wrap up this conversation, I want to bring up something that Siskel and Ebert used to do. And if you know who they are a couple of complete bitches who posed as straight men to talk about movies. These ladies, every year while talking about Oscars nominations, would pick the single worst nominee of the year and explain why they thought it was the worst one. Ira, I challenge you to pick the single worst Oscar nomination of 2025 for you.
Mine is actually going to go to Conclave.
For?
Best Costume Design.
Okay.
Now we said it. Actually, now we said it. The Vatican designed those costumes. Okay, bitch. Like, what are we really doing with Best Costume Design? Okay, you probably called up the Pope and asked for some of his extra clothes. Like, you're fucking kidding me. I actually hate when movies like this get into, you know, best costume design, because it's like, well, what did you really do?
Right. Did you Google what do the costumes look like over there? There in the palace?
And then
can we borrow some? Yes.
Okay. I mean, I feel like Camille Grammer here, but like, you need to be honest. And now we said it.
I have to say, that is a really qualified choice. I'm not upset with that at all. Now, I have to say, my standard is, of course, Isabella Rossellini in Conclave, who I believe, as you know, operates a scanner and points at a computer.
She also tells Ralph Fiennes, don't speak to her.
Okay. Four words that are important to the picture. I can't deny that. I'm wondering if there's anything crazier that's upsetting me. Nope, I think it has to be that. I'm looking at the original song options too, and those are competitive. This is just not a shining year for Diane Warren. And as you know, I'm begging for one of those. But I'm going to go with Isabella Rossellini, just because if she's nominated for this, like, she just had so many other roles where it would make more sense if she were up for, I don't know, Blue Velvet, if she were up for, if she got a guest nomination for 30 Rock or something. There are just other places I would rather see her than up for this acting nomination this year. But man, Conclave costumes, you chose well.
I mean, my second was going to be Best Cinematography for Emilia Perez, because I'm like, okay, slap some Instagram filters over this movie, and that's really what we got. I thought the film was kind of ugly to look at.
Also, final trivia question. One actor this year is in two different Best Picture nominees, and this is the third time this has happened to that actor. Do you know who it is?
Timothée Chalamet?
It is. Yes, he's up for Dune Part 2 and A Complete Unknown. A couple of years ago, he was up for Dune and Don't Look Up, which was a real film, and we all saw it. And you can't take it back. Sorry, God. And then also, he was up in 2017 for Call Me By Your Name and Lady Bird.
Who is doing it like Timothée Chalamet? I'm sorry. The other white boys at the moment just really cannot compete where they cannot compare.
No, he is a walking, hot, cool tongue depressor and slays every time.
I mean, like, is it any shock that he is with Kylie Jenner? I mean, that is just like what a celebrity, a male celebrity of, you know, like the 50s or 60s or 70s, like, would have done too. You know, that's like you're bagging Marilyn Monroe.
Right. Precisely. Wow. I do not need to see his plays if he's going the Arthur Miller route. I'm worried about that now. Okay. Stay in the DiMaggio lane. Hit your home runs on the silver screen. Yes.
All I'm saying is at some point, someone will be Oscar nominated for starring in My Week with Kylie.
I think Instagram basically is My Week with Kylie. Yeah.
All right. When we're back, we are joined by Christina Milian. Keep It is brought to you by Viya. Now, let me tell you something about this. I have been using Viya, and this shit is great. I mean, honestly, it's so good that friends of mine keep stealing it from me. They come over and they're like, we want the gummies, Ira. Where are they? I've used to take other CBD gummies, but these really sort of just feel comfortable. They taste good too. They come in all sorts of different flavors and different purposes. And it's really sort of what I use at the end of each night now.
Do you have friends who regularly come over and just steal your stuff? Do you wonder if they're maybe just using you?
Yeah, well, I'll talk to my therapist about that. But for now, they love Viya.
Unlock the power of nature with Viya's organic and vegan hemp extracts, perfect for relaxation and rejuvenation. Viya is the only lifestyle hemp brand. They use compounds found in hemp along with active plant extracts to create products, each with a specific effect in mind. Whether you want to get better sleep, ease anxiety, enhance your mood, or just get hi, they have something for you. Their products range from 0 milligrams to 100 milligrams of THC. So these guys have you covered whether you're looking to microdose or enjoy more potent effects.
They also have one called Higher Love. And let me tell you, you don't need Love Potion number 9 after that.
Ooh. Now you've got me thinking about the hits of Steve Winwood. If you're 21 and over, go to Viya.co/keepit and use the code KEEPIT to receive 15% off. And if you're new to Viya, get a free gift of your choice. That's Viya.co/keepit. Use code KEEPIT. After you purchase, they ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Again, viia.co/keepit. Use code KEEPIT. This year, enhance your everyday with Viya.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no-bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling Bea. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
We have been rocking with this week's guest ever since she dipped it low. She's the reason I can even tell time from her song AM to PM. Her music got our attention first, and then her roles in cult faves like Love Don't Cost a Thing, Be Cool, and one of my favorite franchises, Bring It On, Fight to the Finish, kept our eyes glued to her every move. She's now here to talk about her latest role as Detective Maria LaGuerta in Dexter, Original Sin. Please welcome to Keep It, Christina Milian.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I've been around for a while. I mean, that intro just tells it all. Don't ask my age.
it's giving Kennedy Center honors. Yeah, look out.
It's giving, yeah. It's giving way back in the day, like put me on a penny or something.
No, wait. I don't feel like you've ever had a role like this before. How new a venture is this for you to play something like this?
Wow. So playing Maria LaGuerta, this is my first detective role. I played cops before and I played some other really serious roles and Step Up and stuff. But this is my second time that I've actually played a character that was pre-existing. This time, the only difference is this is such a legendary show and it's so epic. The whole Dexter series, people still talk about it. And it's been, the first series ended back in 2013 and people still talk about it to this day. So when I booked this role to play Maria LaGuerta, I, dove right back into watching the show again. I was like, damn, this is crazy. I had prayed that I wanted to do something that my family was going to be proud of, but I was I had no idea I was going to get a challenge like this. So it's fun. It's fascinating. It was challenging. I was nervous as hell the whole time, just because I just wanted to do it well. Because, people make comparisons instantly, They want to compare you to something that they already know and love. So I just wanted to make a younger, fresher, obviously she's 15 years prior. So it allowed me to create this life that came before that. But I just wanted to see what were her circumstances? What was happening in her life that made her different 15 years prior? And also what made her captain of Miami Metro. So it was fun, but I will, like I said, I was shitting my pants the whole time. Can I curse here?
Yes, you can.
Okay, good. I was literally so nervous. And then on top of that, you add the layers of Christian Slater, Patrick Dempsey, Sarah Michelle Gellar. They're all on the show. And the legend that is Dexter. So, no pressure at all, but total pressure. I don't know if everyone else felt this exactly the same way that I did, but from beginning to end, I was just oh, Lord, please. I just pray I'm doing good. So far, we're doing pretty good. People like it.
No, I'm really, really enjoying the series. I mean, I was a big fan of the original Dexter. And so I love the throwback vibe of it all. And it's really, really been a fun watch.
It's been.
I want to ask you. Yeah, you're welcome. I want to ask you about this cast. First of all, you mentioned the great people that you're with, and I have so many questions. Like, you know, Sarah Michelle Gellar is in this, and you. I feel like you two are people who've been around since that period. You know, like, did you have memories of maybe interacting with her before in the past? And then you have Patrick Dempsey on this, and Love Don't Cost a Thing was a remake of Can't Buy Me Love, the movie he starred in.
Finally, someone talks about it. Oh my gosh, no
You're the first one.
Who's talked about that? Like, nobody's picked up on, hello, connection, Can't Buy Me Love, Love Don't Cost a Thing, it's the same movie, hello.
Yes.
You know, I thought, I one of the days that I was working with him, I told him, I was like, hey, so I finally, like, slipped it in there because I was like, I feel, you know, I was kind of nervous anyways. And I finally was like, but he's so nice. Everyone's so nice, by the way. But he, I said to him, you know, I did this movie with the same producers who did your movie, Can't Buy Me Love, and it was called Love Don't Cost a Thing. And so we just had this whole conversation, and I meant to take this picture with him. I wanted to take this picture with him where he was in his character from Can't Buy Me Love, and I was Paris Morgan. You know, we were just going to do like a, you know, a side by side, or he had to put me on his back, something, something that looked like the cover of one of our movies. But, you know, he didn't make it to our press junket in New York, and that was when I was going to get it done. I was like, yes, I told him. I was like, when we get time and we're not in our character clothes, can we take a picture as our character? And I said, the fans will go crazy.
The streets are waiting for that.
I'm going to have to make it happen. If I see him anywhere, I'm doing it. I'm finding him and I'm going to do this. But yes, no, that would have been legendary. And he's a legend and he's dope. And he's actually, it's an honor to work with him and with Christian Slater. Oh my gosh. Christian, out of all the people, he's, him and Patrick are of my earliest memories, like the both of them, because I just remember so many movies in the 80s. I'm an 80s baby, so 80s and 90s, watching all their films and like high school movies, all that stuff that they're really implemented in my life, and like Tiger Beat and all those like posters and all that stuff. I had that stuff. So when I was working with them, I'm looking at them like, oh my gosh, like I didn't think about it until I was there. And I was like, all of a sudden you have these flashbacks and you're looking at them and you're playing off a scene as your character. But in the meantime, you're having this dialogue in the back of your head about like, oh my God, oh my God, you know, that's so-and-so. I really trip out. I still trip out about that kind of stuff to this day. Like, I've been doing this for 30-something years, and I trip out about the people that I'm working with or the place that I'm at that moment. I'm just like, whoa, this feels, I'm grateful. It's a blessing. And then Sarah Michelle Gellar, I love her. She is like, you know, I found a picture of us sitting at a fashion show together just recently. And so I actually didn't remember that. We've had a lot of time over time. But so I guess I did meet her at that time, maybe. We took a nice picture. But since then, and now being in her presence now, she's actually so nice, and she's so like aware, and like she makes you feel so comfortable. And I guess like for me, Sarah Michelle Gellar's, you know, recognizing some of the stuff that I've done or talking about like, oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, wait, you paid attention to me? Like, you knew who I was? So, and meanwhile, I was like watching her movies like, what was it? I Know What You Did Last.
Of course.
All those movies.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I was like, that was my dream career to have. I was like, I want to be part of this group of people and doing these movies at that time. That was like my goal. Like my, you know, they had The Secret back then. I didn't have that, but that was my visually, it was on my board. And I was like, I want a career like that. Like, cause I'm really an actress first, to be honest with you. And then music came along and that happened, but I became more famous, I guess, from the music. So, but yeah, altogether, like, I feel like actually my career is kind of rounding up to what my goal was. So it's pretty awesome. I get to work with
her. It's actually interesting to me that you are seemingly as kind of bowled over by other stars as
oh,
you are.
Yeah.
It's like, it's cool to see, but who else, like, have you kind of tangled with that, like, knocked your socks off?
Oh my gosh. You want to know who I cried over? But I think anybody would do this. Janet Jackson.
Oh, my God. Of course.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. But this was, like, years ago. If I see her now, we can have, like, a conversation. But this was at the, like, the helm of, like, the beginning of my career. And I was at MTV when TRL had its heyday. And I was just having a meeting. And they were like, you know, Janet's downstairs. She's here as a surprise to surprise everybody on the show. Do you want to meet her? I was like, That was my idol. Like, that's my idol. That's. So I was like, yeah, I would love to. I was like, clinical. They brought me down. Do you know, I walked into this room and like, I couldn't speak. Like, I was at such a loss for words. I said, hi, nice to meet you. But like, when I looked at her, it was like she had this glowing aura around her. And I was just, and then she was like telling me about myself. She's like, I saw your music video and this and that. And she's telling me, again, one of those things that I'm like, whoa. And like, I introduced her to my mom, and then she was talking and talking. I couldn't say anything else. And the second she left the room, I literally bawled for 2 hours, happiest tears ever. But yeah, that was a moment. I'm sure she's heard this story before, but yes, I still, like, I can remember that story to this day, and I can feel it, so.
There's also, like, a quality about Janet Jackson, too, where, like, you almost don't know how she'll be socially, because she's sort of kept to herself. So, like, when you actually meet her, I'm sure it's, like, I don't even know what to do. Like, I have no sense of her, like, vibe or whatever, you know?
I know. You're like, could we be friends? Could we not? Like, is she not? You know, you don't know. But, and then she's got that sweet tone, you know? She's got that really soft, nice tone. And it's just like, and here I am with my big old loud voice. Like, I wish I could be cute like that. I was like, she's a queen. She's amazing.
Well, speaking of I Know What You Did Last Summer and movies from that era, Sarah Michelle Gellar was also in Scream 2. I love the Scream franchise, and I'm a big Wes Craven fan. Now, you were in Pulse.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Well.
And he co-wrote that, at least. You know, that was a fun Scream Queen, like, moment for you. Do you have moments from like that movie or from other movies like that are little known that you really enjoyed?
I really enjoyed doing it. We were in Romania. We shot it in Romania. So that was an experience, like early 2000s. They just came out of like communism. They came over there as like dogs everywhere, gypsies everywhere. Like, it's an experience. But when you look at it now, I'm like, the actors that I worked with, like
Kirsten Dunst,
and Kirsten Bell and Ian Somerhalder. Mm-hmm. There was some really great, and oh gosh, what's her name?
Also Octavia Spencer.
Octavia Spencer, yes. She was love Octavia. Octavia is crazy, by the way. I loved Octavia. So yeah, there's some really great actors. It was a crazy concept. It was fun. I forgot that was a Wes Craven. That was a Wes Craven film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
It's also interesting to me that you said you kind of always knew you were more of an acting person than a music person. I want to put you maybe on the Mandy Moore track there, who talks about how that was kind of a disorienting time for her, like doing pop music. Did it feel strange, like having success in one thing when you sort of had always planned to have, express yourself otherwise?
Yeah, not at all. I was like, one of these things is working. Thank God. I've been doing this for so long. nothing about it. None of it felt weird at all. You know, at my time when I started acting, we just didn't have as many roles and that many options back then, and fewer roles, especially for leading roles. So I was used to being like girl number two in a movie or girl number four, like, you know, best friend number two, you know, until you could finally work your way into finding these lead roles. And so the music just really hit it off. And when I got into the music, I mean, I was doing music for a long time, so don't get me wrong, it was kind of like hand in hand. But when I finally got my record deal and I came out with AM to PM and I came out with all those songs and the albums, that's when I started to, like, I got Love Don't Cost a Thing off of an offer, and I did a movie called Torque off of an offer. They were both offered, and I was like, what, people offer people movies, you know? I had been auditioning my whole life to just play mediocre roles, and all of a sudden they're offering me and greenlighting movies at a studio off of my name and just the fact that I had this fame off of the music, you know, business. So nothing about that was overwhelming. I was super happy. I was like, hell yeah, this is what I've been waiting for.
Well, I have to say that, first of all, we are gay men who watch music videos at after parties, and Dip It Low is always thrown on.
I
mean, you in the ink.
The paint, yeah.
The paint, yes. Beautiful. Yes. Love that video. But I have to ask, of all your singles and music that you made, how does it feel that I feel like the song that people know you the most for now, especially thanks to TikTok, is the Kim Possible theme song?
I mean, that's crazy. Well, I think it makes sense. It makes sense because the TikTok generation, all that. I mean, I still hear people play that song as like a ringtone on their phones. So it was a huge song for Disney. And I felt it at the time. Like, I would get like these awards from like Radio Disney, like number one for 26 weeks. And I was like, oh, cool, you know? But I didn't think much of it because I was like on the road and I wasn't a kid watching, you know, cartoons. Mm-hmm. But it really did something. Like, I didn't know that it would be part of like my, you know, discography as like a thing, you know, and it paid off to do like a little, to do that song. It's fun. Cause I just did a TikTok with one of my friends and it always blows up every time. That's like a Kim Possible thing, like a choreography or like a, you know, me singing it. It's like, it blows up like with the people. So people like nostalgia. I like nostalgia. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of nostalgia, too, I mean, obviously, yeah. We talked about how AM to PM and Dip It Low are like songs we'll be listening to forever. It's now becoming clear that era, that TRL era, like 25 years ago, is like the best pop era. Like the one, the songs we'll be listening to forever and ever. And my essay question to you is, if there's a song that wasn't yours from that time that you could have claimed or had a version of, what would it be?
Ugh, it would have been Slave for You.
Mm. What a song. Mm. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Britney was the reason why to this day I'm like, have, you know what they say, muscle memory. She's the reason I have a six pack. Like, even if it's under some fat, like right now, it will always come back because I worked my ass off for a six pack back then, because that video, that song, oh my gosh, what Pharrell did with that track. Oh, that is epic. That was a time that, like, these kids have no idea what they missed out on. What a time. I would have loved for that would have been the song. Like, if I could have stolen that song, that one.
Also, if it's fitting, I can picture you doing that song. Yeah,
maybe I can come back with it, you know.
Yeah,
they did it all the time.
What are we saying? Of course. Yeah.
Now keep your song. Keep your song, Brittany. She slayed that.
Before we let you go, I do have to say I was such a huge fan in 2004. Like, this is right when I'm sorry, 2006, when I am in college at this point. But I loved the album So Amazing. And and especially the song that you have with 3-6 Mafia, they're still on playlists
Tell
of mine.
Tell me who's gonna rap.
Yes.
Yeah, you know what? Those who know. That album was fire. First off, my label did me so wrong with that album. Because, you know, that album was like, they knew and they had planned with me. We were going to do like a whole shift. Like, this is the shift. This is the sound. Like, we're going to move more urban. And then you can kind of like grow back into your pop. Like, we had this whole plan. Anyways, I had such a good time making that album with Kool & Dre in Miami. And it was such a vibe. But the time we put out that single and we put out the people were already like, saying like the second single is gonna be what's that song? Did it up in my room, I'm lighting candles, Landle in my handle, thinking why? How could I let the situation get the best of me? Okay, so the fans decided that was the second single. And it was blowing up on its own. I'm telling you, on its own. And why did my label let me go? Like, and the album came out. Album came out and sold, I think, 70,000 the first week, which back then is considered low. It was like 60 or 70,000. Sorry, don't quote me wrong. But it's between those. And that's considered low back then. But they dropped me 2 weeks after the album came out. And they dropped, who else did they drop? They dropped like a couple other people. The same label, they dropped like four really big artists at that time. And I think it was like Budget Cuts or whatever they were doing, but they let us go. And so that album just never got to like continue to flourish. Only fans really know about that That album, and they still talk about that album, and that's still one of my favorite albums to this day.
Platinum in my house, okay?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. No, I know, believe me, like my real fans or people that love music at that time, like R&B, that was a really fun R&B song album, and it said a lot. It spoke to a lot of people's lives, and that's what I loved about it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been really lovely to talk to you today.
I hope I didn't talk your heads off.
Oh, please.
No, no, please.
We're just so glad you're safe from Dexter, obviously.
Why are you leaving me?
Yes.
I'm safe for now. Give me another 15-20 years. I'm dead.
Nice to know, and you're in the prequel too, that Dexter didn't off you.
We can see
the original series.
If anything, we might have to find out eventually what that whole crush was about in the first season. There was like a whole crush happening, and you're like, and then it just disappeared by episode 3. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll have to build it up. We'll build it up. So hopefully everybody watch Dexter Original Sin now. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're on episode number 7 this week. And so you have plenty of time to catch up and watch the rest. So yeah. It's good. I hope we get another season, because I actually, now that I'm not nervous anymore, I just want to have fun and shoot.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Oh my God, it was so much fun. Come back in every time. You're so much fun.
Bye.
Love you guys. Thank you so much.
Catch Dexter Original Sin on Paramount Plus. I love it, so you'll probably love it too. And we'll be right back with Keep It. Keep It is brought to you by Fatty 15. Well, I just had flashbacks to high school.
I was going to say, was that your screen name?
Oh, but Lewis, how much time, money, and energy have you spent on health and wellness products to look and feel younger?
I have a vial of the substance right here, and I am ready to pound it. That's actually a really good question, because I am a big protein shake connoisseur. I go to a gym where I spend, I believe, millions of dollars, and I assume it all adds up. But I'm so excited to share with you guys C15 from Fatty 15, the first essential fatty acid to be discovered in more than 90 years. It is an incredible scientific breakthrough to support our long-term health and wellness, and you guessed it, aging and longevity. Based on over 100 studies, we now know that C15 strengthens our cells and is a key longevity-enhancing nutrient, which helps to slow biological aging at the cellular level.
In fact, when our cells don't have enough C15, they become fragile and age faster. And when our cells age, our bodies age too. This eventually led to studies finding the first new nutritional deficiency in 75 years called cellular fragility syndrome, caused by a lack of the essential fatty acid C15. As many as 1 in 3 people worldwide may have low C15 levels and cellular fragility syndrome.
Fatty 15 is a science-backed, vegan, 100% pure C15 supplement free of flavors, fillers, allergens, or preservatives. It's so easy to add these things to your early morning. I get up, I have my iced coffee, I have my prep, and I have a little Fatty 15. That's the entire Lewis Fertel diet. You know all my secrets. Fatty 15 is on a mission to optimize your C15 levels to help you live healthier longer. You can get an additional 15% off their 90-day subscription starter kit by going to fatty15.com/keepit and using code KEEPIT at checkout.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vitor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vitor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back for our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis, what's grinding your gears?
One of my least favorite things about very, very mainstream pop culture is Super Bowl commercials culture. It just gives me nothing. It's all about mixing like icons of the past with, you know, brands that won't go away. And it's supposed to be a fun irony we're all in on, but it's just extremely corporate and kind of humorless to me. Anyway, I believe I just saw in a campaign for Uber Eats that Martha Stewart and Charlie XCX are paired up and doing kind of comedy bits with each other. Martha Stewart says, "Oh, I saw the name Charlie XCX and I thought it was somebody's Netflix password," or whatever she said. Jokes. Anyway. And then Charlie XCX said, "Oh, I saw your name attached to this and I thought you'd be catering it." It's not Laurel and Hardy, okay? It's not Abbott and Costello. Just a random pairing of people that doesn't really do anything for me. I am excited for the Grammys coming up because I want to know how much Charlie XCX's brat phenomenon will register with these voters who are, as you know, are in their late 130s. So if they had a brat summer, it near killed them, I have to say. But just keep it to Super Bowl commercials in general. It's just such a weird thing to be excited for. It's crazy that I feel like I have to kind of beg people to be into Oscar nominated movies. Like they feel like homework to these people. And yet you really are wrapped up in like what Doritos are up to in 2025. It just, you know, kind of sucks a little bit.
Also, I hate that Super Bowl commercials now are basically not even Super Bowl commercials. They all debut before the Super Bowl.
No, right. There's no, right. And we're amped for them. Like there's like a whole campaign to prepare you for the commercials too. So it's just this like Ouroboros situation that's really annoying.
The only person who did it last year well was Beyonce.
Correct. And as you know, she just stages the Super Bowl whenever she wants. She's like, I'm going to perform on this Christmas thing and it's the Super Bowl now. I did laugh when Martha Stewart apparently told Jimmy Fallon the other day that she was offered to host SNL after being released from prison, but her parole officer said no. So maybe someday. That might be kind of fun for her. We'll see.
That could have been her original comeback.
Yes.
And in that sliding doors universe, she's never besties with Snoop Dogg.
Right. And he continues being the guest artist on 175 pop singles from 2000 to 2020.
I mean, he is the reason I knew all the names of the other Pussycat Dolls. Ashley, Nicole, Jessica, Melody, Kimberly.
Yeah. And Kermit is in there too. Yes. Yeah. Also, it must be said, now that you brought up Pussycat Dolls, there was a recent lip sync to Pussycat Dolls Buttons on Drag Race, and neither of the girls stepped up. That is like the draggiest song of all time. Also, if Paddington ever does drag, he should do it to Buttons. Picture him like rubbing that marmalade down his shirt as the buttons come off. That's the bear from Peru.
I thought he would do Michael Jackson's Jam.
Oh, that could work too. Would Michael Jordan also be in that video with Paddington?
All right. My Keep It this week goes to Pee Wee Herman star Paul Rubens, who, as you know, is dead.
Quite, yes.
But apparently he is dead and loving it because in a new documentary, he comes out as gay. Posthumously.
What?
In the documentary, which is titled Pee-wee as Himself, it's a two-part docuseries that debuted at Sundance Film Festival, which I thought was just a place for Lisa Barlow to wander around taking photos with people.
Yeah, and like 50 Cent like throws you vitamin water or whatever. Yeah.
It's going to air on HBO and Max later this year, but in it, Ruben says, "I was as out as you could be, and then I went back in the closet. My career would have absolutely suffered if I was openly gay, so I went to great lengths for many, many years to keep it a secret." That's why your career would have suffered. Not the gooning in the front row.
Gooning is the theme of the episode. Did we not say that up top? Sorry about that. Well, it's just also one of those, it's like, okay, maybe your career would have suffered. Like, I'm sure the politics of that time were very fraught. And also, he's playing like a very weird character. So maybe if people hear it, they're gay, they could be repulsed or something. But at the same time, coming out posthumously, I mean, does it get darker than that? Like, you didn't come out at all. You're in a crypt. You're in the crypt. You're not coming out of the crypt. You're stuck in the crypt.
Well, you know, have you heard some of the tales from the crypt?
Oh my God, do I miss that guy?
He was doing poppers.
Yes.
Left and right.
He was lit, shall we say. Yes.
Also, Paul Rubens died in 2023. There was plenty of time.
Yes, right. Like, he could have done some of his 60s out. Yes. Also, by the way, doesn't he come from, like, the Groundlings and stuff? Like, I know he had, like, lots of gay associates who are out and stuff. I don't mean to blame him. I don't know what's happening in his life. It's just, like, this is a depressing story that's meant to be spun another way, and I can only see the depressing.
Plus, I mean, like, we already knew he had a movie called Big Top Pee Wee.
Oh, my God. And if anybody was... It was Mr. Herman.
He was a bit of a blouse, okay?
Oh, yeah. I was a bit of a cherry, you know, plush and ready to be sat on.
Oh, well, I... You know, I think this is a first. I don't think I've ever yelled at a gay man for coming out after death.
No. Yeah, in a way, it's impressive. Maybe in the future, more holograms will come out.
Yeah, I'm just standing at Hollywood Forever Cemetery going, never in my life have I yelled at a girl like this.
I have one photo in my hand. It's of you, Pee-wee.
It's from your obituary.
Yeah. I printed it out.
Also, speaking of gay at funerals... It just makes me think of Heather's. I love my dead gay son.
Right. I love my dead gay Pee-wee. Yeah, right. Here it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, something to muster. Something to think about.
Thank you to Christina Milian for joining us. And thank you to our listeners for listening to us talking about jacking off all episode.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. It's diagnosable. Get Freud in here.
I'm waiting for a gun oil ad, okay? We'll do one.
Oh, you think we're not above that? See you next week.
Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review or leaving comments on the YouTube page.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Bill McGrath. Our associate producer is Kennedy Hill. And our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Fertel, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Sheng, and Rachel Gajewski.
This episode was recorded and mixed by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Thank you to Matt DeGroot, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America, East. And as always, Keep It is filmed in front of a live studio audience.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. And with all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vitor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vitor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It
doesn't sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.